This is an extra special segment. We're really excited to have our guest today. First of all, joining me right here is Salon contributor Dee Watkins. Hey, Dee, how are you today?
Hey, how you doing? Hey,
Dee. And joining Dee and myself is the eminent civil liberties scholar and attorney and Harvard Law emeritus professor, I should say, I think, and the author of a new book called The Case Against Impeaching Trump, as well as many other books, Professor Alan Dershowitz. Thank you for being here, sir.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
And listen, as someone who has been called a card-carrying member of the hard left, I would like to welcome you to
our space today.
We're happy to have civil disagreement if such should occur.
I hope it will.
And such other discussions as happen. In fact, I have a personal note to throw to you, which is that my mother was one of the American communists whose civil liberties you personally defended as a student many years ago at Brooklyn College. And I want to sort of thank you and applaud you for standing up for the First Amendment rights of people with whom you strongly disagreed.
Well, thank you. You know, it brings back memories because I was the president of the student government at Brooklyn College, and I stood up against the firing of Professor Slakauer and others who were called Fifth Amendment communists. I grew up in a very anti-communist background. We hated Stalin. We hated what he had done to the Jews. We hated repression. But I stood up for the rights of communists. There was a young man I remember named Steyer on the campus who would come and hand out leaflets, and they would arrest him. And I would always come to his defense. I wasn't even a lawyer yet, but I knew I was going to become one. And in those days, of course, the McCarthyites said, "You're complicit with communism." And then when I defended the rights of Nazis to march through Skokie, "You're complicit with Nazis." Then when I defended O.J. Simpson, "You're complicit with murder." Today, I'm simply defending Donald Trump's civil liberties and constitutional rights, and I'm being accused of being complicit with Donald Trump's policies.
Extremely eloquent. Dee, you got a question?
Yeah, so in this book, you touch on how complex the process of impeachment is. Yeah. More than what you know, many others may know. So actually explain it to us. What would it actually take for Trump to get impeached?
Well, there are several approaches to impeachment. Former President Ford, when he was the minority leader of the House, and current Congresswoman Maxine Waters say, impeachment, if a majority of the House wants to do it, it's done. There's no law. Mm-hmm. And if two-thirds of the Senate wants to do it, it's done. There's no law. It's a lawless process. In my book, The Case Against Impeaching Trump, I take a completely different view on that. I say it's a completely constitutionally lawful process. You have to impeach a president only if you can demonstrate that he or she, I was hoping I was going to be able to say she during the 16 election, but I unfortunately have to say he, has committed a specified crime, treason, bribery, or other high crimes or misdemeanors. Now, unless you can prove that, then impeachment becomes an unconstitutional process. And that's the thesis of this book, and it's controversial.
Now, is it your contention, I believe it is, that there are two presidents in our history who have been impeached, Bill Clinton and Andrew Johnson. Neither was convicted or removed from office. But I believe it's your contention that neither of those impeachments was actually legitimate or constitutional.
That's right. The only legitimate one was Nixon, which never came to fruition. Right. The Andrew Johnson one was so totally lawless. See, look, he was a horrible, horrible president, replacing our greatest president in history. He did a horrible thing. He set back Reconstruction in the South. He changed the nature of America. He introduced or supported Jim Crow laws. And then he fired the Secretary of War after Congress passed a statute saying a president can't fire anybody who's been confirmed by the Senate unless essentially he's unconfirmed by the Senate. And he was impeached for that, and he came within one vote of being removed, but he didn't commit any high crimes or misdemeanors. And subsequently, the Supreme Court ruled that he had the absolute right to fire the Secretary of War.
Right.
And Bill Clinton, you know, talk about low crimes and misdemeanors. He committed a low crime, you know, in the Oval Office and then testifying falsely about it. That wasn't the kind of crime that Hamilton and Madison had in mind when they adopted the framework of high crimes and misdemeanors.
Now, one of the criticisms of this book and the argument that you make, and I believe that you're essentially going against, for example, colleagues or scholars whom you may esteem, such as Lawrence Tribe, your former colleague at Harvard, Alan Lichtman at American University. They have both contended that impeachment essentially is a political process.
Why is
it important to you? What is the importance of this distinction?
I think it's important because I want everything to be done under the rule of law. And when you have a process set out in the Constitution, for example, the Constitution says you need two-thirds of the Senate.
Right.
What if the Senate decided they wanted to impeach based on only 60%, not two-thirds? You couldn't do it. The Constitution says two-thirds. It also says treason, bribery, high crimes and misdemeanors. There's no difference between the two-thirds requirement and the substantive requirement of what crimes have to be committed. Mm-hmm. So it's very important for me that we don't expand these kinds of provisions of the Constitution, or we don't expand the criminal law. I don't want to see concepts like obstruction of justice accordion-like expanded so it fits anybody. Today it's Donald Trump, and we may like that. Tomorrow it could be President Sanders or President, who knows, Warren. And you don't want to make precedents that apply across the board.
What does character come into play?
Character doesn't come into play in impeachment except in this respect. If you have decided that the president has committed an impeachable crime, you still don't have to impeach him if you think he's a man of high character or a woman of high character who serves the country well. Where character comes into play is when you vote. You vote against somebody who doesn't have... I voted against Donald Trump. I voted for Hillary Clinton.
I take your point on this. One of the questions that comes up for me is you're essentially arguing, and it's very elegantly argued, that effectively you must prove the high crimes and misdemeanors before you impeach the president. I assume you...
Before you remove the president.
Before you remove the president from office. I assume you subscribe to the view that a president cannot be indicted for a crime while he's in office.
That seems like the constitutional rule, because it does say that the president can be indicted and tried after he's removed from office.
Right.
That would seem to imply that he can't be indicted and tried while he's in office. Now, there's some contrary precedent here. When Alexander Hamilton was killed by Aaron Burr, Aaron Burr was the sitting vice president. He was actually indicted, not federally, but by the states of New York and New Jersey, but he never came to trial.
He never got charged, right?
Never got tried. He got charged.
He got charged.
But he never came to trial. In fact, it's a funny story, because he then, while he was still vice president, presided over the impeachment trial of Judge Chase. Mm-hmm. And some wag said, usually it's the judge who presides over the trial of the murderer. Here we have the murderer presiding over the trial of the judge.
Now, I know you've heard this argument, Professor, but you seem to be creating a circular feedback loop here where it's extremely difficult to prove or establish that the president has committed a high crime or misdemeanor. But if you don't do that, you may not remove him from office. Why is this not a defense of the imperial presidency?
Well, the framers of the Constitution set up essentially an imperial, not only presidency, but Senate and House and judiciary. Remember that you can't prosecute a senator or a congressman for what they've done while they're in the House or the Senate. You can't prosecute a judge. There are some terrible cases where judges have done terrible things and they can't be prosecuted. The framers said, we don't want the British system. We don't want a system where the parliament can remove the prime minister. The president is an independent branch of the government, and we want him removed only for high crimes and misdemeanors. If you have a bad president, you got to wait a number of years and then unelect him.
So would you say that...
All of the pieces are there. It's like all of the meetings and the Putin praise and, you know, his actions. Everything's screaming collusion. It just hasn't actually been proven yet. Once it's been proven, then your stance will be...
Well, it depends what they prove. If they prove mere collusion, just an agreement between Putin and him, it would be a horrible thing. Unfortunately, it wouldn't be a crime. If they can prove that he told Putin to hack the Democratic National Committee, that's a crime. If he told Putin that he would pay money,
like when he said Russia should look into Hillary's emails.
Right. Well, if the emails, it depends. If the emails were already, here's the analogy. Mm-hmm. The New York Times and the Washington Post published the Pentagon Papers. They also published the material stolen by Snowden and Manning. They were innocent of the publication. The people who were guilty were the people who stole them. The same thing would be true here. If the hacking had already occurred, then it would be not illegal for a candidate to say, give me the product that you have has been hacked. But it would be illegal to say, go ahead and hack and then give it to me. Maybe a technicality, but it's an important one.
As an expert, how would you define treason?
Well, I don't have to define it. It's the only crime defined in the Constitution. It's specifically said out. Treason shall consist only, the word only is in the Constitution, of, and then it sets out the exact words you have to bear, you know, take up arms against the government or give aid or comfort to an enemy. And you need two witnesses. So in the book, I pose the following hypothetical. Let's assume you had one witness to a president actually committing treason, really treason, giving a nuclear bomb to our enemy, committing treason. You have one witness, and he tape records it. So now you have a witness and a tape recording. But the Constitution says two witnesses. Okay. You'd have to acquit the guy. The Constitution is a very difficult document to live with. It imposes all kinds of restraints on what we can do. Or let's assume you had a president who committed all these crimes, treason, but because of politics, they only got 60 votes against him instead of the 67 votes. He stays in office because of the Constitution. You know, there are certain parts of the Constitution that are living. Due process, equal protection, cruel and unusual punishment. But there are parts of the Constitution that are dead. 35 years. You got to be 35 years to be president.
Right. You can't
You're going to have
that.
The most brilliant person in the world who's 34. He can't be president.
So, you know, I actually agree with your analysis that there is not proof at the moment of any specific crime that, President Trump or, or someone in his inner circle may have committed with regard to collusion with the Russians. But what interests me also is your suggestion that the president's intentions don't matter.
Only in certain respects.
Okay.
Okay. So if a president engages in a constitutionally authorized act,
firing James Comey, for instance.
Or pardoning somebody. Let's take a famous case. President George H.W. Bush pardoned Caspar Weinberger and five other people on the eve of their trial. We know what his purpose was. We know what his intent was, to prevent them from pointing the finger back at him. He did it for the worst possible purpose. Nobody ever suggested it was a crime because the president has the power to pardon. And just like the Senate has the power to vote, you can't ask a senator why he voted for something because people have mixed motives. Why does a president do something? Because he's patriotic, because he thinks it's good for his party, because he thinks he'll be able to get a good memoir out of it when he finishes office, good speaking fees. Everybody has mixed motives. Once we start probing the motives of why a constitutionally authorized act was engaged in, we're going down a very slippery slope.
So is it fair to say that we have a temporarily imperial presidency, that while he's in office, he has nearly unlimited power, but that after the person leaves office, he can then be prosecuted for anything he may have done that might have transgressed the law in some way?
Yes, but I don't think we have an imperial presidency now. Checks and balances are working quite well. President's losing a lot of his battles. Courts are striking down a lot of what he's doing. The media is holding him accountable. The academy is very much against him. The churches are, for the most part, except for the evangelical churches in the South, pretty much against him. A lot of his own staff members are quitting. Checks and balances are working. So I don't think we have an imperial presidency. I think we have a president who sometimes acts as if he's an imperial president, but he's subject to checks and balances. He doesn't like when the court strikes down his legislation.
No.
Nobody does, but that's the way our system works.
Now, you have identified yourself in this book and elsewhere as a liberal Democrat, I believe.
Yeah. Anti-hard left, anti-radical.
I understand.
You and I wouldn't get along politically,
but
I'm a liberal, a genuine civil libertarian liberal.
I got
a charter member of the American Civil Liberties Union, which I wish maintained its status as a real civil liberties union. That's who I am, right?
So can you mention some specific policies of President Trump that you don't agree with?
Oh, we got about an hour? Okay. I disagree with separating of families.
Good.
I disagree with what he said one day, which was outrageous, and I really let him know it on television, where he said, we don't want people from those SH countries.
We want more
Norwegians.
Yeah. Right.
That was
a
code word.
Yes,
that was a code word. You know how much African-American black people have contributed to this country compared to Norwegians? I don't want to say anything negative about Norwegians. But there was no excuse for that kind of statement. I disagree with the president on separation of church and state. I disagree with the president on gun control. I disagree with the president on that absurd thing they did yesterday about denying that breastfeeding a woman is a good thing in order to help the companies that send this terrible substitute for breast milk to poor countries. I can go on and on and on. There are very few policies of the president I agree with. And I'm not defending the president's policies. I'm defending only his right not to be impeached without a crime and not to have the criminal law stretched to fit him. I also have long opposed special counsel. I opposed it for years. And it's structurally something that I'm against. I would be just as opposed to it if Hillary Clinton were president and they appointed a special counsel for her. And I shook my fingers at the president and said, you want to appoint a special counsel for Hillary Clinton? You're against special counsel. You can't have one rule for you and one rule for her, and they can't be the opposite, one rule for her and then a different rule for him.
It's like, at what point do all of these negative things add up and, like, make the case for going against what would be constitutionally appropriate? Like,
never.
Nothing? There's this, like, racism, sexism, separating people
from
their families.
We have elections.
Bragging about grabbing women. All of these different things add up.
He did that before he was elected. and people voted for him. People of every background, women voted for him. African American, small numbers.
Yeah, like eight
small
not,
numbers. Okay.
Too many. Too many.
Jews voted for him. Catholics voted for him. He got 3 million less votes than Hillary Clinton, to be sure. But a lot of people voted for him and seems to be maintaining his base. And the more he did and said things like that, the more his base, including evangelical Christians, supported him. It's bizarre. Maybe we didn't do a good enough job. Look, I contributed a lot to Hillary's campaign. I campaigned for her. I supported her. She's a close friend. I think she's terrific. We just didn't do enough to get her elected.
You've made very clear that you supported Secretary Clinton. But is one of the issues with you and Donald Trump that you're willing to make an alliance with him partly because he has a very strong stance in favor of Israel, which I know is a very important issue to you?
It is, but Hillary Clinton had a very strong stance in favor of Israel. And if that were my position, I would have voted for Donald Trump. No, I voted for Hillary Clinton on Israel. I voted for Barack Obama, even though his views on Israel weren't as positive maybe as Mitt Romney's or McCain. So Israel is one factor in the decision. But I'm an American. I'm an American first. I care about a woman's right to choose. I care about gun control. I care about separation of church and state. I care about the entire liberal agenda, and I oppose the entire conservative agenda.
Now, I do understand your argument for why you feel like a nonpartisan commission would have been a better path than appointing special counsel Mueller. I get the nature of the argument. But it strikes me that there's an element of whataboutism here, that you are perhaps inadvertently, perhaps not, lending fuel or support to those who sort of say, well, everybody's guilty of all this stuff, and they start throwing stuff at the wall. Peter Stroke and Spygate and Uranium One, most of these things have now evaporated. The sense of apprehension and uncertainty about Trump and the Russians is then equated with these largely imaginary conspiracy theories on the other side.
Well, I'm very much against investigating Uranium One or the Hilton, the Clinton Foundation, or Stroke or Comey. I don't think anybody should be criminally prosecuted. That's why I wanted a nonpartisan commission without the power to indict. I want them to have the power to inquire and find out the whole truth. Remember that a special counsel only looks at one side of the issue. They're only looking if there's enough evidence to prosecute.
Right.
An independent commission would look at all the evidence and produce a report telling us how to stop Russia from intruding in our elections. I have no doubt. I think there's 100% certainty that Russia tried to influence the outcome of this election. Whether they succeeded or not, I don't know. But they tried to influence the outcome of this election. That's horrible. We have to stop that. And we have to have a commission to tell us how to put an end to that the way we had a 9/11 commission. That really worked well.
I guess from my perspective, it's like, it makes perfect sense. But I guess from the shoes I have to walk through in this country, everything works for Trump because he's old, rich, and white, or just rich and white. And me being a black person, like, if I did like a fraction.
Is that true? Are you
fraction,
a black person?
Yeah, me being wearing this skin, if I did a fraction of the things that he did while running for office, I wouldn't even make it out of my neighborhood, let alone state, let alone anybody's primary. So it's like, it's just lopsided. So it's like, you want to reference the Constitution, you want to believe in it, you want to carry a little booklet in your pocket, you want to love it, but it's just lopsided.
I agree with you. And I think that the injustices that occur in this country, in the criminal justice system, particularly to minority people, are outrageous. I've been fighting against it since I went down south in the early 1960s. It's a horrible system in which you have, if you're poor and black and innocent, you have a much higher chance of being convicted than if you're rich and white and guilty. And that can't be our system. The same thing is true with bail. You're going to be denied bail if you're poor and black and innocent, even before you're convicted, before trial. But if you're rich, you're going to be able to sit around in your home and get a bracelet. That's a terrible injustice. It doesn't mean that the rich person shouldn't be able to be out pending a trial. Everybody should be. But certainly the poor person should be out pending trial as well, unless there's overwhelming evidence that he's a danger to the community or a flight risk.
And that's how I feel about Trump. Like, I just feel like, you're right, we do need a system, and we have to believe and subscribe and stand by something, but for the greater good of our country, like, will America be here in 2 years? Like, will we
It'll be here.
Will we be sitting here?
We'll be. I don't know if I'll be here, because I'm old and white as well. But I can tell you the country will be here. It'll be stronger for it. The system of checks and balances is working. We have a midterm election coming up. Everybody should get out and vote. And
you say that one more time, please.
Please get out and vote. I'm going to contribute to Democratic candidates all over the country who have a chance of unseating Republicans. I'm hoping the Senate might flip, and that would help on the Supreme Court nominations next time around. That's where the fight should be fought.
Let's talk about that for a second, because as we are speaking today, the president is going to announce a Supreme Court nominee this evening, apparently. Yeah. Who's it going to be? Do you know? Do you have a guess?
I have some guesses, but they're not informed guesses. I think he would benefit in the short term with his base politically if he nominated the woman from the Seventh Circuit, Judge Barrett.
But I've been referring to her as the Christian lady.
Well, let me tell you what's really dangerous about her. She not only believes that there's no constitutional right to choose to have an abortion, she believes there's a constitutional right to life, which may mean that she thinks the Constitution would forbid New York State from allowing a woman to have an abortion. That abortion, as a matter of constitutional law, should be prohibited because the Constitution says you can't take life without due process of law. And she believes the fetus is an innocent citizen, basically, of the country. And that is very dangerous. Now, will she get the nomination? Probably not this time. But stay tuned.
If Justice Ginsburg retires, right?
She might get the next one. So I think now it's between two young white men.
Relatively speaking.
Well, they're very young compared to the Supreme Court.
Yeah, yeah.
Remember, when we set up lifetime appointments to the Supreme Court, we expected people to be appointed at 50 and die at 55.
Sure.
Today, people are being appointed at 40, and they're going to die at 95. Right. I don't think the framers contemplated anybody would serve as a judge for 50 years. But, you know, again, it's a dead constitution. The Constitution says they serve during good behavior.
Well, we've arrived at this place where we know that whoever he nominates is, of course, not going to answer any questions about Roe versus Wade or about their personal views on abortion, but also is likely to not answer questions about Griswold, about Brown versus Board of Education, about these things that probably you view as fundamental items of precedent at this point.
Yeah.
Is it actually appropriate for that person to not answer a question about whether they think Brown versus Board was correctly decided?
Well, it's interesting. It's better to answer. It's better to not answer the question than to answer it perjuriously, which some have done.
Right.
I mean, you get Justice Thomas who said, oh, abortion? I never thought about that. It never crossed my mind. I have no view on that. Does anybody believe that was true? Or when some justices say, I just call balls and strikes. I'm the umpire. I just call balls
nonsense.
And strikes.
Nonsense.
Of course, they are very much influenced by their passions, their background, their history, by their religion. But you can't question somebody in their religion. The Constitution has a clear rule, and it says no religious test shall ever be imposed for any federal office. So when Senator Feinstein asked this woman about her religious views, she crossed that line. And if, by the way, Barrett ever gets to be on the Supreme Court, she should have a big picture of Senator Feinstein in her office, because Senator Feinstein is the one who put her on the front page.
I think that's true. Did all of this happen because when Robert Bork was nominated, he actually answered all the questions and managed to torpedo himself in the process?
He didn't have to answer the questions. Robert Bork wrote almost as many books as I did. Not quite. This is number 39.
Yeah. Oh,
Bork, you know, had six or seven, but hundreds of articles and hundreds of opinions. So he didn't have to answer any questions. He had written, and he wrote very provocatively. He wrote once, I think, that a woman's right to choose has no greater status than a company polluting the environment through its chimneys. I mean, absurd things that only a professor would write. You know, we write in order to provoke.
Right.
But it's very hard these days for a professor to be nominated to the Supreme Court, although Steve Breyer was a professor, but he only wrote about administrative law. But if you're writing about constitutional law and you're a professor, it's probably not going to happen because they can't ask you the question, but they can read your books.
When you speak of checks and balances, you think the court will balance itself out? Right? You think?
No, I'm very worried.
Because Kennedy wasn't really a moderate.
He was a very conservative on a lot of issues, but he believed very strongly in gay rights.
There were a handful of the issues that you know about, civil liberties.
Affirmative action, and a few very important issues. The same thing was true with Justice O'Connor. The same thing was true with Justice Souter. But the justice that people misunderstand most often is Justice Scalia, because he had such strong views. Mm-hmm. But he was very civil libertarian on the issue of criminal justice, particularly privacy of the Fourth Amendment, right, to confront witnesses under the Sixth Amendment. He was pretty positive on the First Amendment, but he had such strong views on other issues that was so to the right that he was a mixed bag. Justice Gorsuch, I don't think, is liberal in any issues.
Should Trump be able to nominate someone while he's under investigation, or should wait till this is over?
Clinton nominated two justices, and they both voted against him. And Nixon, the justices who he nominated, voted against him. So I don't think that's really a factor. It won't be a winning argument. But you know, look, there's one possible gambit that Democrats could conceivably try. It takes 51 senators to have a quorum.
Mm-hmm. So they could
If all 49 Democrats were to stay home and Senator McCain, tragically, were not be able to make it to the Senate, they'd probably carry him in. But if he couldn't make it to the Senate, he's a really strong, strong man, they wouldn't have a quorum.
That's interesting. You can't do it with 50 plus one, 50 plus the vice president. That's not a quorum.
I don't believe so. The Constitution says quorum. Quorum for the Senate is generally 51. I don't think the vice president counts to make a quorum. I think he counts to cast the deciding vote.
Right.
You know, these are things that Democrats are talking about. They're exploring. They're gimmicks. They're just like the Republicans did, but the Republicans did it successfully. Didn't even give Merrick Garland a hearing. He would have been a great centrist justice. He would have been a real swing person because he's liberal on some issues, conservative on some issues, brilliant student. I remember him from Harvard. And also, of course, this is going to upset the Harvard-Yale issue. There are now, five from Harvard,
what
three from Yale.
What could be more important than that?
That's a key issue.
I mean, that was, I guess, procedurally legitimate. It was within the laws. But politically, that struck me as an illegitimate move.
Think it was not only politically illegitimate. I think it was constitutionally illegitimate.
Is that right?
If I had been President Obama, or if he had asked me advice on that, I would have said, nominate him and swear him in as an interim justice, and then let the Republicans try to remove him. The Constitution doesn't say that the Senate has a right to sit on a nomination. It just says, with the advice and consent of the Senate. That means to me, up and down. You advise or you don't advise. You consent or you don't consent. You can't delay the way they delayed.
Well,
I think that was unconstitutional.
What about the option? I want to talk about the nuclear option. What about the possibility of expanding the court? Is that within the constitutional parameters? Could the Democrats, with a future majority, decide to do that?
They could, and they would probably be treated the way Franklin Delano Roosevelt was treated, with contempt. It was one of his weakest moments. He did it for a very good purpose, to uphold the New Deal. Mm-hmm. And he proposed that for every justice over, 70 maybe, a new justice could be added. But under the Constitution, you could tomorrow make the Supreme Court 25 instead of 9. 9 is not a magic number. It doesn't appear in the Constitution.
So what do you say to people who are going to be studying you like 50, 100 years from now and say Dershowitz was great? He was a great guy, but then he just turned into a Trump guy. What do you say to those people? Like, what would you say to them?
Look, you always worry. The last bad thing you did is always what you worry will lead the obituary, right? I'm proud of standing up for the civil liberties of everybody. Look, I'd be so much happier if Hillary Clinton had been elected and they were trying to impeach her, trying to indict her. I'd be the hero of Martha's Vineyard because I'd be saying exactly the same thing. I'd be your hero and your hero. Yeah. I'd be saying exactly the same thing. But I'm saying the same thing. You can't teach an old dog new tricks. Mm. I'm a civil libertarian. I've always been a civil libertarian. I think my tombstone will say a misunderstood civil libertarian. Look, this book, they're selling it now on Martha's Vineyard in plain brown wrapper. So people in the vineyard who want to read it can read it.
I don't think that's actually true. Is
of course
no,
not.
No, I think.
As to quote President Trump, hyperbole.
Hyperbole,
this
yes.
This is hyperbole.
Yes,
but
capital
this is
letters.
Hyperbole,
yeah, yeah.
Right?
I do want to pivot back to the infamous, now infamous, Martha's Vineyard incident. Surely you can see that people being rude to you, if indeed they were, on Martha's Vineyard, or a restaurant owner not inviting Sarah Sanders to stay in the restaurant, those are indeed issues of civil liberties.
They
those
are.
People
I
are
defend,
free to
oh,
be rude
I
to you.
I defend their right. Let me tell you, when I speak and they boo me or they interrupt me, I'm the first one to defend their right to do it. So I defend the right of people to be rude, to be mean, to be nasty, to tell people to leave their restaurant, but I defend my right to criticize them for it. Just because you have a right, the Nazis had a right to march through Skokie. I have a right to criticize them, and I have done so. But, you know, the misunderstanding is people think I compared myself to the victims of McCarthyism. I remember McCarthyism. You talked about that.
Yeah.
I would never compare myself to the people who went to jail, lost their jobs, committed suicide. But I think there is a comparison to the lawyers who defended communists. They weren't disbarred or they were just shunned. People said, oh, my God, you're a communist lover. You're a commie lover. You're a pinko. I heard that on college campuses, and now people saying I'm complicit. One guy on the Vineyard said I was as complicit with Trump as intellectuals were complicit with Hitler. Now, I don't like to be compared to anybody who helped facilitate Hitler,
Possibly, obviously.
Yeah. And, you know, as a civil libertarian, defending someone's rights is not being complicit. I was not complicit with O.J. Simpson. I was not complicit with the Nazis or the communists, nor am I complicit with Donald Trump.
So for you... Here's where a lot of people are going to come down, and you're aware of this, that are you actually defending a consistent set of principles, or are you trying to create a legal framework under which President Trump can potentially evade impeachment if it happens? Because you have suggested that the Chief Justice has to preside and has, in fact, the authority to accept motions or deny motions as the judge in a regular criminal trial would. That there is an entire set of legal procedures and architectures that will come into play that could get President Trump off the hook, even if he is impeached.
Well, but if he commits a crime, then he's not going to be able to count on my defense, because then the Constitution says he can be impeached and removed. Right. But if he or Hillary Clinton or who the next president might be are impeached for something that isn't a crime, I'm going to stand up for them the way I stood up for Bill Clinton, the way I would have stood up probably for Andrew Johnson. I don't know if I would have, because he was such a terrible president. And even on Nixon, who I wanted to see impeached. I was in favor of impeaching Nixon. As a civil libertarian, I didn't like the fact that he was named as an unindicted co-conspirator. Because you can't defend yourself if you're named as an unindicted co-conspirator. There's no trial. It's the end of it. It's just an accusation. So I actually did defend even Nixon's civil liberties, though I strongly supported his impeachment. He clearly committed impeachable crimes. What he did is he told his people to pay hush money to witnesses. He told his people to lie to government officials, the FBI. He destroyed evidence. Those are all crimes, real obstruction of justice. And so I supported his impeachment. And I would support any president's impeachment if they committed a high crime or misdemeanor.
Tell everyone where they can get your book.
Oh, you can get this book on Barnes & Noble. You can get it at Amazon. You can get it in the airplane terminal. You can get it in bookstores. And you can get it online. You can get it at Kindle. You can listen to it. And it's really a short book, 150 pages. And it's the first 30 pages in which I lay out the case against impeaching any president. The title of the book is The Case Against Impeaching Trump, but it really should be The Case Against Impeaching Any President Who Hasn't Committed a Crime.
Thank you.
You think it's a lot more difficult to do it. Is it even possible to impeach a president? Could it ever happen?
It could happen, but there'd have to be a clear crime. There are three categories of crimes that this president could conceivably be charged with. Those that occurred well before he ever even ran for president, business dealings, no evidence that I've seen of it, those would not be impeachable offenses.
Right.
Those that occurred while he was president, obstruction of justice, tampering with witnesses, if they could prove that, those would be impeachable crimes. And then there's that interesting middle category when he's running for president. I believe that if a president gets elected as the result of criminal behavior, there would be a case to be made that could be an impeachable offense, even though he wasn't president. Framers never thought about that. It's a close question. There's no firm answer to it. Reasonable people could argue either side of that, but that is a close question.
Well, we've had a surprisingly peaceful and amicable
so far.
Dee Watkins, thank you. Professor Alan Dershowitz, thank you so much for joining us.
Good. You wouldn't pick on an almost 80-year-old man. You're not going to get physical. This is a serious... Look, if we could have this kind of intellectual discussion on Martha's Vineyard or at Harvard Law School or in other places, I'd be thrilled. So I want to thank you for having a serious conversation. You don't agree with everything I've said. Probably you don't agree with much that I've said. But I think we've had a really good educational event.